My name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. I thought I'd wear one of my more conservative suits this afternoon. I'm from Santa Monica, California. Very strange place. And my home group is the Big Blue Group. And I've watched that group go from 10 people in the basement of a church who were involved in one of those workshops that she talked about, and they were excited about doing this work, and they were interested in finding out about steps 10, 11, and 12, and they were all out there making amends. I watched that group go to about 120 regular members, 5 meetings a week, 2 retreats a year, big huge Christmas party. Well, I got sober. I'd never seen that before when I was new. I got sober in Denver, Colorado in 1982. And then the groups that I was involved with, you know, had been there forever. And it's been a real joy to watch that. I want to thank you for inviting me to come again and share. It's always an honor and a privilege to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my 3rd year here, and I just absolutely love coming to Nashville. The people and the hospitality and everybody's just great, and it's nice to have friends in this room, and that's a big difference than the way it was 10 years ago when I got here. It's even pretty amazing to be invited back to the same place more than once. three times in a row. I mean, there's not too many places that 10 years ago I was invited back even once, let alone 3 times. It's just not the way it was. And the miracle of this program and the place that this process takes me to, and it just makes me terribly grateful. And I believe in expressing that. I used to think it was just a feeling or something that you get to think about. And, you know, I found out in this program through people like you that gratitude and love are about action. And I express that action by saying what I'm going to do and doing what I say I'm going to do, which I believe, and it's everything that's been given to me in my life was given to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that definition, which is some of the time in my life a reality, is the best definition of honesty that I've ever heard for me as an alcoholic. Every inventory I've ever written and all the amends that I've made have to do with me not saying what I'm going to do, being honest and doing what I say I'm going to do. And that's a definition that works for me in my life. I have experience with that. It was kind of funny when Teresa called me. I was in Denver 2 weeks ago, and she was asked to be the host and to chair the meeting today. And some strange woman answered the phone, and these people I stay with whenever I go to Denver, and they weren't sure if I was busy or not, and did they want to bother me, and they called downstairs and said it was Teresa from Nashville, and I got on the phone for a second, and I was real short, and told her I was in the middle of something. And you know, if anyone would have ever thought, or if you would have told me a year ago that when that happened, or that a year later when she called, I'd be sitting in a living room in Denver, Colorado with an American Indian man going through a ceremonial ritual as part of the work in Alcoholics Anonymous to look at the first 3 steps, and I would have never thought that would be possible. I was not, and at regular times in my sobriety, I am not real open-minded, and I have a desire for some reason, by the grace of God, to experience more. Not unlike my drinking. I wasn't a half-assed drinker. I'm not really a half-assed member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope. I want it all, and I get encouraged by the people that encourage me to go for it. The sad thing is that most of the time when I'm excited about doing something, and you know those people at every one of your birthdays where it's like your fifth year, and they tell you that sixth year is gonna, the sky is gonna fall and everything is gonna crumble, and then you have your seventh birthday and they tell you, boy, that eighth year is just gonna be terrible. And that just hasn't been my experience, because I've continued to submit myself to a process that goes against my very nature and against my will, contrary to the way I live my life. And I get taken to unbelievable places. I just saw Mary Pearl in Flagstaff, Arizona, around the first week in June, and I feel from just what's going on since then, because I decided to resubmit myself to another person and this process once again in a totally different place than I even was then, and that's really not that long ago. It was interesting that at that conference in Flagstaff, out in a big state park, and about 2,000 people, and a big campgrounds next door, and we're all staying over in this really nice hotel, and you spend the weekend with your host, and we were talking the whole time, and he didn't mention what he was about to say to me, and we were up at the front, and there's all these people, and they're reading how it works, and about 1 minute before they were going to introduce me, he leans over and he says, oh, I forgot to tell you, a lady that was registered here at the conference died last night over in the campgrounds of alcohol poisoning. We'd now like to introduce our speaker from Santa Monica, Joe H. And needless to say, that was kind of on my mind by the time I got up there. And I said, you know, all this weekend I've kind of gotten into the spirit and we're having a lot of fun, and everybody seems to be saying that we're exactly where we're supposed to be, doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing. And when my friend leaned over to me a minute ago and reminded me of what happened over in the campground last night, I had a shift in my thinking, and I realized that we're all exactly somewhere we absolutely shouldn't be doing something we absolutely shouldn't be doing, because I'm the guy that should be over in that campground dead from alcohol poisoning. And my perception changes. That's something I think the 10th and 11th step are all about, and I've been very interested in the last couple years. And I asked to talk about this year when Don called me, because of some recent experience I've had where I spent a 12-month period working with a man that I asked to help me on just these two steps. Of course, I was working with other people, and I was involved in my group and doing all kinds of other stuff, but I have had a pattern because of decisions I've made, I've had a pattern for the last 9 years where I go through the steps, and then I hit the wall, either physically or spiritually or emotionally or circumstantially, and then I go through the steps again. And that's because of a decision I've made, and that's contrary to some of the beliefs in AA. There seems to be two schools of thought among people that have been around that do stuff with the steps, that one school says that you work the first 9 steps once and live in 10, 11, and 12, and the other school says you do it on a regular basis, however it comes, or a yearly thing, or whatever you decide. And I reached a point several years ago where I wanted to make a decision about that. And I don't think it was my second time, I don't think it was my third time, but I wanted to decide about that. And I started looking around AA, and I started doing some reading, and I was going all over the country with my sponsor, and I traced it all the way back to the very beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found out there was a big difference between our founders and some people that were influential with them. And I read a lot about Bill, and he definitely had an amazing experience, and he definitely continued to have amazing experiences. And I mean, I tried to imagine once, 2 years sober, waking up in the middle of the night with a blinding light in your room and sitting down and writing that chapter, How It Works, 2 years sober. And he definitely had some amazing experiences. And then he wrote a lot about a long period of time of depression and problems and trying all different sorts of things that he writes about and Pass It On and other books. And then he wrote about what the encouragement was for him to move out of that and how he moved out of that after trying all this kind of stuff, because that's my nature and it's been a lot of my friends' natures. And I look around and I try to watch people in AA that have what I want, and I've watched that happen to a lot of friends. And then I started reading about Bob, and he was a much more stable person, and was really encouraged by a man that I don't hear talked about a lot, like Dr. Silkworth or Carl Jung. And this man's name was Harry Thibault, and he was a psychiatrist, and for some reason he knew a lot about one aspect of alcoholism that I think was really important to the people that have had an effect on me. And what he wrote about was the resurgence of the ego having had a spiritual awakening. After having a spiritual awakening, the unbelievable power of the ego to reassert itself. And it was some of the awareness that Bill came to, and it was some of the influence that Bob was moved by. And Bob continued to rework the first 9 steps. And then I thought, well, you know, that's a long time ago, and what do I want? And I think that's a place that a lot of us reach on our own paths. That's probably several different times, as I have, where you kind of reevaluate things and you ask yourself, where am I at and what is it I really want here? A valuable consideration for me the last few times has been because of the number of people. It really came from a friend of mine that called me a couple years ago, and he and I got sober together. And at one time when I still worked in the treatment field, when I was new, he was my boss in this adolescent treatment center where I worked with kids. I no longer work in that field, but he was a very good friend, and he called me one day and he said, I woke up today and it was my 9th birthday and I had no one in Alcoholics Anonymous to call in Denver where I got sober. And I felt really sad, and I said, why did you feel sad? He said, because of a series of decisions that I made, thinking I was doing AA because of the field I work in, a series of decisions I made that I wasn't even awake to that I was making, totally asleep, I have placed myself outside of Alcoholics Anonymous to where there's no one I know in AA anymore. And I thought, I started to feel sorry for the guy, and I started to think, you know, that's really sad. And then it dawned on me, what was really sad about that is that he was asleep to the decisions he was making, not that he had done that. Because I've seen other people do that. I was with a lady 2 weeks ago in Denver who, after 14 years in Alcoholics Anonymous doing this work on a regular basis, which I think is a whole different, not any better or any more special, but I think it's a whole different proposition than just staying in AA and staying sober and riding on what the experience you've had, which is like what I've done several times. And I spent some time with this lady who, after 14 years, came up against a belief in her group in Alcoholics Anonymous that she needed to resolve, and she had to leave AA to do that. And the last several years, when I come up to the third step with whoever I've asked to help me that year, it's been really beneficial for me to consider, is this where I still want to do this? Because I've been at a lot of these conventions, and you know when they do the countdowns, you always see a big gap between about 7 and 10 or 11. Big gaps. And because of the impact that phone call had from my friend that was a really good buddy at one time, it wasn't so much that I'm afraid to do that, because there also came a time where I had to get past that fear. I think there's a lot of superstitions in Alcoholics Anonymous that I don't know whether you've said them or not, but I've heard them, that I've had to get free of staying in AA, to stay in AA, to continue to get free. You know, kind of like those guys at each birthday. Or when you talk about wanting to do something to really get free and somebody says, can't do that. Or you bring something up like my job needs me or my family needs me or my mother's dying or and I'm not going to be at meetings for a while and, you know, am I free? Am I really free to do that if someone needs me in my life? And people would say, can't do that. You know, you'll probably drink if you don't go to meetings. Because they think going to meetings keeps them sober or even to think certain things. We're big in our group when looking at the first step with someone by looking at the idea of the opposite of it, that maybe you're not, to find out you really are. And considering those questions with whoever you're working with, kind of like safe and protected. And there's people that say to my friends, gee, that's not even something you really even want to think because it's stinking thinking. And there's no way in a healthy way to do that. Everything negative is negative and everything positive is positive. Well, I think in the last couple of years, I've really experienced the duality of things, that within every negative there is positive and within every positive there's negative. For example, like, there was a time when I thought working with others, helping others, can only be good. Or self-will can only be bad. You know, this black and white thinking that I have. And through a series of inventories, I found out, you know, there's times when under the guise of helping others, I've caused harm and it's been negative. And a good way for me to hide, to keep from looking at myself. And you know, there's even been times where self-will has done good. I mean, what is it that new people really see when they see us? I mean, if they saw a bunch of saints who were terribly spiritual and of God, and I mean, sometimes my defects attract more people than my assets. But you never really know what's going to hook a drunk. So to open yourself to be a whole being, to admit truth about being human. To examine a day, or to examine a 9-month period, or to examine a 5-year period, or to examine a 24-year period in Alcoholics Anonymous and see the truth about the lies. The 10th step is about continuing. I think the most important word in the 10th step is the first word of the 10th step. And I think the second most important word is a word that's not in the 10th step. It's really an idea that comes from the 3rd step. But I think the most important word in the 10th step is to continue, which leads me to believe you're going to do something you've done already. Now, a lot of people will sell you short and they'll say, and it's amazing for a lot of us that have been through this work and a lot of us that are excited about this big book and a lot of us that are excited all over this country about returning to the roots and basics of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're new and you look on the wall and you read the first step and you think, that's about all there is. Once again, my ego wants to keep me where I am, doesn't really want me to go any further, which is one of the major functions of my ego. And it will tell me that what I read on this wall, or what I read and how it works in the short form, is about all there is to step one. I need to admit that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life is unmanageable. And then you meet somebody who's a little more excited about AA, or excited about AA, and you go through this book and you find out, my God, there was so much more to step one, to fully concede to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic, than I ever even dreamed of. And then you read step two and your ego says, well, that's all there is to step two. You just need to come to believe that there is a power greater than yourself that can restore you to sanity. And the ego will even convince you the second step is about insanity. But about all there is what's on the wall or in the how it works, right? And then someone takes you through, or you go somehow, you're taken through that unbelievable chapter to the agnostic. And even if you've been around 10 or 15 or 20 years, no matter how many times you've done this, you come face to face with your own agnosticism, even having had experience with God. And you say, my God, step two is alive for me at 10 years as it was at 1 year, probably even more because I was in a fog then. And there's so much more to step two than what I thought was on the wall. And then 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, so much more than I thought was in the short form. And then I get somewhere with amends, which is one of the things I'd like to talk about today. Where do we really get? But you get somewhere, wherever it is you get with amends, amazing things start to happen. And it's one of the only places the big book talks about, somewhere between 9 and 10, about be careful not to rest on your laurels. You're headed for trouble if you do. For alcohol is a subtle foe. But isn't it interesting? I'm at a point where I don't even think alcohol is a problem anymore. We're headed for trouble if we do. And my mind, my ego snaps shut. And I try to convince myself, there's really no more to the 10th step than continuing to take inventory and promptly admitting when you're wrong. And once again, my ego has convinced me all there is to the 10th step is the short form on the wall or in how it works. But I've just experienced, and it's really hard to talk about 10 and 11 without talking about 1 through 9, because especially 1, that's my reason for continuing to do 10 and 11. Or maybe it isn't anymore. Maybe I'm like the guy who I heard not too long ago, and he said, after 23 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized I no longer had a drinking problem or any kind of a problem with alcohol. I now had a living problem. And one day I figured I could use a little alcohol to help me with my living problem, and I've been unable to get back to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's a promise in the 10th step says that the problem will be removed. We're in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. So the question they posed to me was, because the problem is removed and you're in a place of neutrality, does that mean the truth about alcohol is no longer true? Just because the problem with it is removed. And is it possible what my ego can do after 5, 10, 15, 20 years of living, or 6 months, of living in 10 and 11, to bring me back to the problem with alcohol? And I'm fighting resentment, and I'm fighting fear, and I'm having trouble with selfishness, and I'm unwilling to review my day, and I'm up against all this stuff, and my ego convinces me that I'm not fighting booze, I'm fighting fear, or anger, or whatever it is I'm feeling. Is it possible that any time any alcoholic anywhere who's sober is fighting any of those things, the bottom line, because we're alcoholics, we're fighting booze, if I'm fighting anger, or if I'm fighting fear, or if I'm fighting dishonesty? I went to this guy one time that's been helping me for the last year with 10 and 11. I said, I'm having trouble with honesty. And I explained to him what I thought I was having trouble with honesty. He says, you're not having trouble with honesty. You're having trouble with dishonesty. And my perception changed. So in going through this work on a regular basis, because it's what I've decided I want to do, because of the people in my life that have what I want, and because I don't ever want to drink again, and the truth about me and booze, I was at a meeting after our little trip to Arizona, and this guy said, I've been an alcoholic for 16 years, and at 15 years of sobriety, I was diagnosed with cancer. And when I realized that I had something I couldn't do anything about, there was a willingness in me to go to any lengths. And I thought to myself, my God, isn't it sad that he didn't realize that with alcohol? Guy came to my house not too long ago, and he said, 9 years ago I got sober, and 7 years ago I was diagnosed HIV positive. And I decided to live with the HIV virus. And it has not progressed. But my primary disease, alcoholism, has progressed 9 years past my last drink. Will you help me? I thought, my God, how could you say no? The clarity and the perspective this man had about what was really wrong with him. Even wanting to get free before you go. But how do we know when we're going to go? Do I really want to get free? Or do I just want relief? Now, there's a lot you can do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to receive relief. I certainly know a lot about that. You go to enough meetings, you call enough people, you do enough of this, you do enough of that, even with the steps. Well, my intention for doing this work is because of the unmanageability of my life, because things are a mess or I'm feeling bad. And that's my intention for doing this work. And I'm using the middle steps, 4 through 9, to solve problems in my life. And I get some relief from step 5, or I even make it to 9, and I make 20 or 30 amends, and I feel better, and things have straightened out, or at least I'm seeing them differently. I poop out. I don't go for anymore. Because my intent was not to really get free. My intent was to just feel better. Maybe that's all there is in AA. Maybe the people that says, boy, if you get some relief, that's about all you're going to get. Thank God for the people in my life and the people in these meetings and people like you that have said, you know, you can really go for some stuff here. God is either everything or He's nothing. Why are you selling it short, Joe? You know? And it's amazing. Sometimes when I go through these steps, the further away I get from step one, the further away I get from step one. Sometimes when I'm lucky or I'm graced or I'm blessed, I don't know what it is. Sometimes the further away I move from step one, the deeper I move into the truth about what I really suffer from. 4 shows it to me in black and white. That fifth step just puts it right in front of me. Look at what the hell I do, and look at what the hell I do with power. I mean, it's no longer a proposition for me or any of you that have been around here for a while to consider what do you do on your own power. Because if you're an alcoholic and you've been here for any period of time, you obviously haven't been just receiving your own power for all these years. But what really gets me, like this last time, when a man sat down with me and we looked at that page in the chapter, The Agnostic, that takes you through each area of your life, personal relationships, your emotional nature, misery and depression, making a living, fear, happiness, being of real help to other people. He says to me, what do you do with each of those areas of your life with the power and grace that you have received? And I see what my ego does with power. Now, I can either put that off and do that every big chunk of time when it just catches up to me and everything's on my shoulders, or I can decide to do that every night. The 11th step gives me something to do every morning. It gives me something to do every night. It gives me stuff to do throughout the day. And the 10th step is where I really get to start to experience some freedom. Because I didn't know what the 10th step was about. So here I was, 7.5 years sober, and I'm writing inventory again. And I come across a form of denial within myself stronger than the denial I came here with, that I don't hear talked about a lot. And I don't think I'm any more special or different or better than any other alcoholic. And if I have it, it must be in other people. And I know it is because I've talked to some people that have had it. And it's a form of denial stronger than the denial of the disease. We all talk about that one a lot. You come to treatment or you come to AA and we talk about denying the disease that you suffer from. The denial of the disease of alcoholism. The only disease that tells you you don't have one. All that stuff. And here I am 7.5 years and I don't even know what I'm writing about. It probably had nothing to do with what I saw. And I'm writing inventory. And out pops this awareness of a form of denial within me that sometimes is real subtle and sometimes it's not so subtle. You know, I don't know if they do it out here, but where I live, you get up to take a birthday cake. 5, 10, 15, 20 years sober. And someone in the back of the room goes, how did you do it? Real subtle, isn't it? And you get up and you say, my name's Joe and I'm an alcoholic, and that means I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. And then you spend 15 or 20 minutes telling them how you keep yourself sober and manage your life. Sometimes it's not so subtle. Sometimes it comes out in the middle of an inventory and it has to do with me taking the credit for what I've been given, and it's no longer grace. It's no longer an absolute, undeserved, unearned gift. It's something I've earned. All this great work. Look at what I've done. I'm keeping myself sober. I just don't drink no matter what. I'm God. Holy moly. And boom. I'm in the denial of the grace of God. Taking the credit for what I've been given. Burst out at me. I had it several times before that. And I will probably have it several times since. Now, do I want to get free or do I want to just feel better? Taking the credit sometimes feels really good. Boy, look at what I did. Let me tell you what I did. A couple of weeks ago, left Denver, got home, called my friend. God, I wrote an inventory in 6 hours. And I was just telling him that I didn't even hardly think while I was writing it, and that I was literally moved by this power, and boom, I'm going to take the credit. Look at these amends I made. Look at this stuff going on in my life. And that's what my ego wants to do to keep me where I am. Because I have an ego that believes, I don't know if anyone else has ever seen this, but I certainly have in every inventory I've ever written, I have an ego that literally believes, I'm not talking about just drunk some of the stuff I did, I'm talking about some of the stuff I've believed and some of the stuff I've done sober. I have an ego that believes it will go on without me. Even if I die, it will be just fine, right? I have an ego that in the middle of the night, out of the middle of an inventory, I have an ego that says things like, if she leaves, you'll no longer exist. If you don't get that money, you'll die. If you lose that job, you'll no longer exist as a human being. Why is it at 3 o'clock in the morning, this stuff my ego tells me that I have to have to live any longer? It's never God. It's always her or it or that. Because that's what my ego wants me to do. My ego wants to separate me just enough from you by either being much sicker or much better. I always thought ego was just me thinking I'm the greatest one in the room. I also found out on the same scale at a different end, it's also me thinking I'm probably the sickest one in the room and nobody understands. To separate me from you just long enough to separate me from me and my own truth about what I am and separate me from God just long enough to put me back on a bar stool, unable to move, screwing everybody in my life over. That's what my ego wants to do. To come to terms with that, to realize that, to understand that, it's a sad thing that that doesn't do anything to keep that from happening. If understanding that, I love when somebody says the way he teaches the steps. The sad thing is, I don't believe you can teach the steps. I don't believe you can study the book and make the experience happen. I don't believe this is a book that's meant to be read. I believe this is a set of instructions that are meant to be done. It's kind of like the difference between knowledge and experience. I mean, a lot of us, me included, came here with a lot of knowledge and were unable to stay sober with all this knowledge. 10 treatment centers, a master's degree in psychology. I'd been a therapist in a treatment center, drinking with the director of the program that I worked for. Came here with more knowledge than any human should have. I met my sponsor. He says, you know enough about yourself, how you feel, and alcoholism to be dangerous to yourself and everybody around you. Why don't you put aside what you think you know just long enough to have an open mind and maybe receive some experience? The best analogy I've ever heard between knowledge and experience is the difference between what you thought it would be like to have an orgasm the day before you had one and what you knew it was like to have one the day after you had one. I think there's a principle in each of our steps that's very seldom talked about that's encompassed in every step. And I think it's really important in 10 and 11. Two, as a matter of fact, two principles. One of them is mentioned in the first step. I mean, and the fifth step. And one of them is mentioned in the third step as far as specific words, but I think they're probably the two most important words in 10 and 11, and that is the principle of admission. The power that simple, I mean, you can trace it back, some of you, all the way to the first time, that kind of freedom you got from, for the first time, raising your hand and saying, my name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. The admission of truth does something in here to me. Wherever I'm at and whatever it is I'm admitting, that's amazing. And the principle of decision. That the idea that to decide is a spiritual principle. They ask you to decide, is this what you want and are you willing to go to any length to get it before you even start? They ask you to decide and remember that you're willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol at the very beginning. Both are mentioned in our book. They ask you to decide at the third step. And here we sit around asking newcomers, don't make any major decisions the first year, and somewhere in the first few months, we're asking them to decide about their will and their life. And this principle of admission, to admit. I always thought, and it was only until the last couple of years, I always thought that to admit meant to give up. And what I realized when this man talked to me about, what does it say on a movie ticket? It says, admit, one, to let in, to let truth in, is an incredibly freeing experience rather than the kind of stuff I used to admit to beat myself up, to feel worse. Or from the fourth column of inventory, to see that your troubles are of your own making and it wasn't them doing it to you. Rather than to admit that your troubles are of your own making so you can beat yourself up and feel better, there's always two sides to this idea of admission. Those of us that get free admitting we're alcoholic and that our lives are unmanageable, and those that feel bad when we admit that we're alcoholic and that our lives are unmanageable aren't there to get free yet. Those of us that see what we see in the fourth step, in the fourth column, about our part with every resentment we've ever had, and it makes us feel worse, from those of us that write that fourth column about every resentment we've ever had, and that truth sets us free, because thank God it wasn't those people's making. Thank God my troubles with self-esteem and pride and ambition and security and personal relations weren't of this SOB's making in the first column. They were of my own making. To get free, not to feel bad. You bring those principles from the first nine steps. You bring what you've experienced from admitting that you're an alcoholic, from coming to believe, from knowing that's an ongoing continuum, from reaffirming that decision on a daily basis. However you do that, to writing inventory, to reading that to people, to admitting truth to people you trust, to asking for that stuff to be removed, to getting clear on the harm that you've caused at whatever piece or day or minute you're looking at, and then make amends, are things you must experience before you can really experience what you can do with 10 and 11. Yes, you can pray from the very beginning. Yes, you can learn how to meditate from the very beginning. But to think that all there is to 10 and 11 is to take inventory, admit when you're wrong, learn about prayer and meditation, and bringing power into all your activities is all there is to 10 and 11, is once again saying all there is to 10 and 11 is what's in the short form on the wall or in How It Works. There was stuff I could do from the very beginning to pray, to quiet my mind, to learn to meditate, and I did it from the very beginning. Before I started these steps, when I started these steps, as I was writing inventory, as I was making amends, please take me to my next amends. Of course you can use stuff from 10 and 11 when you're doing the first nine steps. But when you've made those first 20 or 30 amends, and you can really start to use the power that you've received as a discipline, the ultimate goal being to practice step 12, so there I am from 10 and 11, both of my reasons are on both ends of the steps. My reason for doing step 10 and 11 is because of the truth about step 1. My reason for doing 10 and 11 is because of where I'm taken to do step 12. That is my reason and my purpose. And what more have I ever wanted in my life but a reason and a purpose? And I get that from the first and 12th step. But if you don't do what's in between, all you're doing is the first and 12th step. And we certainly know a lot of people, and there's been times in my sobriety when that's all I have, is I think I know what's wrong with me, and I'm trying to help others. What do they call them? Two-steppers, right? But if I really knew what was wrong with me, I would have to do what's between 2 and 11. So when I'm thinking that because I know what's wrong with me, and now I need to go help others, that thinking I know what's wrong with me is really experiencing the truth about my condition, I'm so far away from the first step as the man in the moon. Because if I really got that I suffered from something that I couldn't do something about, like that guy with cancer, that was my truth with step one, not that I can't drink, that I will drink. If I really got that, I would seek 2 through 11 like a man with terminal cancer. And what's really different from what I suffer from what he suffers from? do I really suffer from something that only a spiritual experience will conquer? Is it just low self-esteem coupled with obsessive compulsive behavior? Or is it a physical, mental, and spiritual disease that no human power can relieve? Do I really believe that? When I've really believed that, I have sought this program, this fellowship, these steps, and being of service with the same willingness and the same eagerness of the guy that came to my house with terminal cancer to get free. This other guy I met with AIDS said that when he found out he had AIDS, he started looking all over the country for people who had gotten free to live with AIDS. I thought, when I found out about getting free in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to look all over the country for people who were getting free of the disease of alcoholism. But to get free of the disease and what it does to you doesn't mean it changes the truth about it. It only puts you in another place to experience something. Last year when I was here, I had three amends I was holding on to that I was aware of. I was consciously holding on to them. I didn't want to make them from that year's inventory. And I watched a movie called Jacob's Ladder. And at the time, I thought the movie was about a guy who went to Vietnam, almost died, came back, and had a whole lot of trouble living just before he died. And I didn't even hear what the guy said to him at the end of the movie. I finished those three amends and I got some freedom. And that's all I really... Some of my friends said it had nothing to do with what you did spiritually. You just saw the movie different the second time you saw it. But all I had done in those few weeks was finish those amends. And I watched the same movie again and I saw a movie about a guy who died in Vietnam. And the rest of the movie was about everything he wasn't willing to let go of just before he died. And at the end of the movie, this man says to him, if you're holding on and you're not free to go, and you're afraid of dying, all you're going to see in your life are devils tearing you away from your life. But if you've made your peace and you've let go and you're willing to go, all you'll see are angels taking you to a better place. It all depends on how you look at it. Perception had changed. I went from a place in inventory that year of thinking that she left me to realizing I drove her away to thinking she had to come back for me to get free to experiencing I could get free no matter what she did. And what really changes here? What really changes here? You ask these people that have been around a lot longer than me. Jobs come and go, or you get promoted, or you get demoted, money changes. Relationships grow, get better, get worse, change, go away, friendships. I mean, the world goes on just because we got sober. The world didn't change. What really changes here, I think, is our perception and our awareness of ourselves, the people around us, and the power of God within each and every one of us. My sponsor's been saying something to me for 10 years. It took about 6 years to go from here to here, from understanding to experience, that long, dubious trail. I understood what he meant the first time he said it. I didn't get what he said for a long time. And what he said was, no one in these rooms is any closer to God than anybody else in these rooms. And nobody in these rooms is any closer to God than the last time they took a drink. The only thing that changes here is our awareness of a presence that's been there all the time. And my perception changed. And I started to see you different. And I started to see me different. And I started to feel different. And I started to experience the awareness of God different. About a year and a half ago, when I met this American Indian man that I was sitting in the living room doing this really weird stuff when Teresa called, I met a year and a half earlier, and I asked him to help me with 10 and 11. He said, you got some amends you're aware of that you haven't finished? And believe me, at the time there was lots of people around AA saying, can't finish amends. You'll never finish amends. And thank God there were some people around this program that said, there is a way to finish amends to the best of your ability, even the ones you can't find. The book tells you what to do. To make every approach, to do everything you possibly can to finish every amends that you're aware of. Finish those three amends. He said he'd help me. I finished those three amends. He said, what do you think is the biggest part of step 10? And I said, where the directions are. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, and exactly what to do when they crop up throughout the day. Ask God at once to remove it, discuss it with someone, make amends quickly if I've caused any harm. And whatever those I need to do in any given moment when one of those things crops up, so I can resolutely turn. You learn how to turn to someone you can help. Who can you help if you're at work and you're plagued by resentment and fear? You can help your boss by doing your job. Right? I thought I had to run off or get on the phone or do something. I ask God to remove it and turn my thoughts. If I can't get past it, I have to do something else. I thought those were the major instructions for step 10. He says, what if I told you that's about that much of the 10th step? This much. And what you can start to do with the 10th step is to learn about proper use of the will. And he read me a statement in this book that I never understood. I thought it was just another one of those lofty statements that I couldn't possibly do anything with. And he read to me, each day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts that must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all that we wish. It is the proper use of the will. He said, what does that mean to you? I said, I'm supposed to figure out God's will and bring it into all my activities. And if my will has to do with helping someone else, thy will, not mine, be done. He said, what did you just say? I said, what I said was that I have no idea what that means, what you just read to me. He said, let's start with this. And he would give me a little bit at a time. And this guy took just those three or four lines and spent 12 months with me. And you know what I think? I think he could have done it with any other two or three lines in that book. And that's what these people that I know that in this program that excite me about doing this stuff do. They'll do what the 10 steps says throughout the day, but they'll take a couple little ideas at a time and find out about experiencing them. He said, whose vision do you think that is? I said, well, it doesn't say that each day is a day when we must bring God's vision of His will into all our activities. He says, no. I said, it doesn't say each day we must figure out exactly what God's will is and do it in all our activities. He says, no. He says, it says each day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. He says, whose vision do you think it is? I said, I don't know. He said, it's your vision. And after finishing those amends, he sent me back to that page in the middle of We Agnostics, page 52, that takes you through each area of your life. It's a good little guide. He said, go through each area of your life and see how far you can see of where you'd like to be taken and write out this vision. I thought, uh-oh, this is like visualization when I used to do self-help stuff where you imagine it and then have to make it happen. He says, no, just write it out. Vision is different than visualization. Vision is different than sight. Each time through the steps, you're always taken further and can see farther than you could before. And this has to do with that vision that you began to set up in the first step. So I wrote about where I think I could possibly be taken in each area of my life. And then I thought we were going to take that and we were going to have to work on it and make it happen. He says, no, I only wanted you to write that for one reason. He says, from that vision, pull out an intent for your life, a general intent for your life. And that intent from that period was to seek and serve God. Because once I saw what I'd really like, I saw that I couldn't make it happen. And about the only thing I can do is that. And I chose that intent. He said, now spend a couple of weeks in meditation just kind of seeing that out there in front of you as a, I hate the word goal, but as an intent, like an anchor with a rope coming back to you. And I did that, and I started to see this intent for my life out there in front of me. And I started to see it as something great to grow toward, that that's what I would like to do. Then he said, now each night when you do your evening review, and you look at the idea of what you could have done better, make a few notes for tomorrow of what you'd like to do better tomorrow, and go to bed. It added about 3 minutes to my evening review, and I started doing a little bit more meditation. So I would do the evening review. I would go through the questions. It's only one paragraph. I would do 10 minutes of meditation. Then I would increase it to 11. Then I would increase it to 16. Then I would increase it to 21. And that's where I found my space, with about 21 minutes of meditation at night. And whatever ideas came out of my review that needed to be corrected, amends that need to be made tomorrow, apologies, something I need to talk to someone about, or what could I have done better yesterday, I put for my little notes in my daytimer tomorrow. That's all I had to add to my evening review. He said, now when you wake up in the morning, he says, it says, first you ask God to direct your thinking, that it be divorced from selfish, self-seeking, self-pity, dishonest motives. So I wake up and I ask God to direct my thinking. I get up out of bed, I go to the bathroom, I make some juice, I take my little time, whatever has to get done, and then I take my 25 minutes. And by looking at the notes I made from the night before, I choose an intent for today. Today, I would like to be more direct, because yesterday I was all wishy-washy, or more honest, or more kind, or more loving. Whatever it is I might choose for that day from what I saw from yesterday, as an intent for today. And then I go through where it says, upon awakening, I read the 10th step, I read the rest of the 11th step, I do 21 minutes of meditation, and I'm more focused to go out into the day. And with an intent for my life and an intent for today, I found out if those two things line up each day, there's more freedom than I've ever had, and I can exercise my willpower along that line all that I wish. It's kind of like if my intent is to get from my house to your house, and I don't have any directions from you to get to your house, and I take off out of my house, it doesn't matter where I end up because I had nowhere to get. But if I have some plans for the day, and I have an intent of what I would like to bring into my day, and I have a general intent for my life, and I have some directions to get there, that's the only time I know I'm off track, when I'm on track. You'll never know you're off track unless you start the day on track. And I found out it was just that simple. So by adding about 5 or 10 minutes to my upon awakening and 5 or 10 minutes to my evening review, I started to feel much more centered. And I started to feel that I was really doing some of the things it said to do throughout the day. That I used to just get going and go and go and go and maybe catch them in the evening review, if not in the next year's inventory. Stuff that I'm asleep to. Decisions I'm making I'm not even awake to, harm that I'm causing, resentments I'm holding on to that are slipping through my work with 10 and 11, and I don't catch them until 6 months later in my next inventory. My God, look at what I was doing. Look at these decisions I was making that I wasn't even awake to, and I'm ending up like my friend with 9 years who didn't have anybody to call an AA anymore, asleep on my feet, dreaming that I'm alive. Oh, I didn't harm anyone today. Good night. I wasn't really angry last week. Good night. And my body's racked and everything's tense and I can't meditate. My health is going down and I'm wondering why. And I'm not even awake to what I'm doing. That started to change. I started to feel more centered in my day. I started to feel that rather than that, few of my friends that haven't finished amends said, gee, it sounds so rigid and it sounds so confining. Hasn't it gotten real narrow? And I had this experience where it felt a lot more roomy, that I could really start to decide about what I want to do in my life. And the idea that a guy like me can be brought to a place where he not only begins to experience God's will, but where he gets to begin to align his will with God's will, is what 10 and 11 is all about. So I started saying some things after 3 months, and after 4 months, and after 5 months, which at the time were only a theory because they had to do with the future. But now I know that they were true. And I'll tell you what it was I was saying. And I would say this in my home group. I would say, this year feels like I'm more awake even to the mistakes I'm making and the things I'm deciding and what I'm catching in my evening review than I have any other year. And even though I know there's going to be an inventory and there's going to be some harm, I feel more awake to the decisions that I've been making more than any other year. At the time, that was just a theory because I didn't have a new inventory and I didn't have any new amends. 1 year later, I just wrote inventory. I have some amends to make. And there wasn't one thing in that inventory that I wasn't awake to that I was deciding to do, whether it was a mistake or not. It's not one of these inventories, my God, look at what I was doing. Now, if that means I'm getting a little bit better, I don't know. If that means I was given some more grace to be moved to a place where there's more freedom, I don't know. But it felt like I was more centered than last year than I've ever been. More focused. And I believe with some kind of an intent for my life of what I would like to do, of what I would like to be, I don't like the word goal, but I love the word intent. I think of the word goal and my mind automatically thinks you have to make it happen from my old training. But with an intent in my life and a place to head toward and an intent for each day of what I'd like to be and what I'd like to do, it seems like there's a lot more room to exercise my willpower along this line, all that I wish. And I learned a little bit about proper use of the will. But when I meet these guys that have been doing this work and that have been doing stuff with 10 and 11 every year, for my spiritual advisor just celebrated her 33rd birthday. She runs that little central office in Denver, and I stay with her whenever I go there. It's the lady's house I was at when Teresa called. The most exciting 68-year-old woman I've ever met, in or out of AA. You ask her about inventory. You know, some of these guys, you ask about inventory and it's like, well, I remember back in 1963 when I wrote, it's like a fond memory, right? And I haven't really been angry for quite a while, and I don't really cause any harm anymore. And I wonder if they're even like me. It's hard for me to find one day when there hasn't been some anger or at least some kind of harm, if I'm honestly doing my evening review. You ask this woman about inventory, she'll tell you about her 33rd major inventory, this year's inventory. She'll tell you about yesterday's selfishness, last night's evening review. And she's right there with you. She ain't somebody with 33 years. She asked me to sit down and hear some of her inventory once about 6 years ago. I thought, oh, my God, this woman with however many years she had then, wants to read inventory to me? Boy, is this going to be heavy. I bet her inventory has evolved to a place that I probably won't even understand it. And I sat in this woman's living room, and she read me her inventory, and they were petty little stupid resentments just like mine, and petty little stupid fears just like mine. And the respect that came within me of this woman, my God, 33 years sober, still willing to submit herself to this process on terms other than her own and not just ride on what she's been given after 32 years. To want more, to want to go for more. My sponsor's been doing this, that a lot of you know, for about 25 years. His life takes off every year. What I noticed this time, I'm still living in the same place. I still got the same friends that were on my resentment list 2 weeks ago that I was feeling tension with every time I talked to them or saw them. Income's still the same. Same house, same beach, same town, same group that I was mad at. And something in me has shifted, and I don't have that tension I had the day I flew to Denver to start 1, 2, and 3. My perception changed. By submitting myself through the first 9 steps to terms other than my own, to someone else's way, against my will, contrary to my nature, against the grain of how I live, I'm once again taken to a different place. This American Indian man called me. We did a fist step on a 13,000-foot peak overlooking Pike's Peak, and he made a little ceremonial altar out there in the middle of nowhere, and I read him this fist step, and a year ago I couldn't have done anything like that. I mean, it has to be done like this, and it broke a lot of my rigidity. And 2 days later he calls me and he says, how are you? I said, I'm feeling great. He says, I think it was a really powerful experience because I've been affected for about 3 days. I said, I think it was a really powerful experience because I've been affected for about 3 days. And he says, you know, one of the things I think really changed with you, amongst some other things. I said, what's that? He said, I think your feelings changed. And now I have to go out and I have to make amends. I can tell you that every year's amends list gets shorter. I can tell you every year's inventory gets shorter. And I can tell you every single year there's been more freedom than the year before. And I can tell you that this year, more than last year, more than the year before that, I am more excited about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you people and myself and what's going on in my life and the people that I work with than any year I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. A couple weeks ago, I was pretty dried up. A little apathetic, not feeling great, tension with friends, mad at the group. That all changed. And all I had to do was some stupid stuff over here that doesn't seem to make any, to have anything to do with anything over here. And it's almost like I've just begun to experience the paradox of the third step. After 10 years. Just a little bit. And I think for me the paradox with the first step is, because the logical mind would say to admit you're powerless over alcohol and that your life is unmanageable, you need to admit that you're powerless over alcohol and that your life is unmanageable. The paradox I experienced with that is, if you look at maybe where you do have power and how you can manage your life, you might find out that you really can't by looking at the opposite. And I think with the second step, my mind says, to come to believe, I need to go home and see how much I believe. And what the chapter of the agnostic does is say, let's see where you don't believe so you can come to believe again. And I think when I took the third step the last several times, I thought that to decide to turn your will and life over to the care of God, you were going to give up your life and you were going to lose your will. And I think what I've begun to experience in the last year and a half is, if you decide to turn your will and your life over to the care of God and you do the work in between necessary to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, you get a new life, a new perception, and a whole new will that you can begin to use properly. Thanks for letting me come.